transport. Well, you were nine in a team.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how many teams do we have? I can't
12,
remember.
12 teams, I 12? Think. Yeah. 12. I think it was 12. Yeah. 12, including the...
But
the,
not everyone had a team.
The rabble.
Because there was a mixture of GAs. All the GAs had a dog team.
Yeah.
And most of the scientists had one as well. Team, so, yeah. So, you know, there were a lot of dogs. And the other odd thing about Stonington was that very rarely in the year was the whole base there, though it was quite a small base.
Yeah.
So in the summer, there was really only the radio operator.
There was radio, diesel mechanic in the summer.
And the doctor, and maybe three people. Yeah. And even in the winter, I mean, we were out over midwinter.
Yes, of course, you were up in Horseshoe. Yeah. North of Horseshoe, weren't you?
So it was, and of course, Bath supplied booze. So there was a bottle of whiskey every week, I think, for...
And then there was the ship's rum. Do you remember in the big...
the big rocks.
So because there were so few people there, it built up into huge amounts. And we used to use gin to clean the windows.
Because we did.
And there were that many tins of ham and stuff like that. Yeah. That was insulation in the floor.
Yeah.
But... So it was a very cheerful base.
How about corned beef for the pups? You remember all those tins of corned beef? There's loads of great tins of corned beef.
And you feed it to the puppies,
really? Actually, we shouldn't have done it. I found out in later years I shouldn't have done it, but, you know, as you live and you get older, you learn these things. But anyway, we fed it
to feed them chocolate?
No, you must never feed that dog's chocolate.
I'm sure we did. It's supposed to poison them, isn't it? But I'm sure we did.
Was it possible to get any peace and quiet there?
Yes.
So there was always evening howl, wasn't it?
We all the drivers used to howl with the dogs as well. I mean, you can imagine what 150 dogs, which probably are about that at any one time. And when it went off,
fantastic.
It was the sound of a lifetime.
That is one of the sounds.
You know, all my life I'll hear it. You
could just hear it start off, couldn't you? And then it swept through and that way.
It ended
abruptly.
Yeah,
absolutely extraordinary.
And then, why was it happening?
Well, they do it every day, more or less. It's kind of happy, you know. They just have a sing.
Oh, right.
But the pups took a while to learn how to end it, and there'd be this magnificent howl of 100 and odd dogs, which would end bang, except for a little. And you can see that the pups looking around thinking, "Oh God, what are they?"
But the thing was, you could enter it. I mean, I can remember, this was at Horseshoes, it was a slightly different time, but same thing. I was out near Lagatellery.
Oh, Lagatellery.
What was the point? Anyway, I was on my own.
Camp Point, wasn't it?
Camp Point. No, that was the one further south.
No, further down.
Anyway,
never mind, go on.
And I was out there, a couple of miles from the base, by myself, and I'd stopped to take a reading or something, and I could feel this tension in the dogs. And I went, and they all started. And, you know, you're part of the team. It's an amazing experience.
Did you ever work out how it was they all knew when to stop?
No. You know, the end of the song.
End of the song.
You might well be right there, Ian.
That's a very good point. Did you at all try to analyse this song, like whale song? Or?
I think we all became rather doggy as we progressed. I think it was in Stonington. I mean, you could go out for 4 or 5 months at a time, you know, on a sledging trip, and maybe two or three of you together, and you kind of run out of, you know, 3 weeks out with somebody, and actually, there's not an awful lot more to talk about, you know, than but we talked dogs the entire time. And you started to, you know, for instance, I can remember I began to be able to smell bitches going on heat. It sounds really silly, but, you know, and you'd think, they're going to, there's going to be trouble, you know. There's going to be trouble with the dogs trying to get at them, you know. And things like that, and you'd learn, you know, I see you get down and bite a dog in anger, you know, I've done it, you know. You know, you know, you could thump them because they were so tough it didn't really hurt them. But if you bit their ear, you know, they're really upset about that. And
yes, that was a good strategy, wasn't it? Because you had been a real dog.
Joined in, you know.
The other sound I suspect you might have heard from time to time were Ken's explosions.
No, that only went on in the summer. Sorry.
There were other other explosions, but I don't know.
These weren't the beans and the untang the tendons.
No, that was it. Was a summer job which we started off at Signy building a jetty, then we moved down to Adelaide Island building another jetty, and the idea was there was a gully. Adelaide Island was always a problem for the ships to unload. They had to transfer it to boats, like a big, the big inflatable that coal mags used to go into. And the captains always hated, I think, well, I get the impression, they always disliked Adelaide Island because currents sort of swept past it, bringing icebergs. They didn't like to linger there.
Iceberg Alley, it was called.
Yeah. So there was the idea was to, this gully that they used, I was supposed to blow these rocks down, and then we sort of build it up into a sort of platform, and then they could load it and get a tractor or something and run things up and speed everything up. So that was my job. And what's coming now?
We all know what's going to happen now.
The question is, did anything ever go wrong?
Once. This particular time, well, it gets more hilarious as it goes on. The governor, Sir Cosmo Haskar, if you'll pardon me.
Cosmic Mudguard.
He was visiting his domain, which the various bases, and he'd gone out with Len Moe, base commander, and the doctor to visit some offshore islands where there's a lot of bird life. Anyway, I was sort of plugging some explosives in. They were plastic explosives, which I wasn't used to because we'd lost some in the damage to the Shackleton. And I'd scrounged these from one of the Navy ships. And so I did this, and someone said, oh, can we take photographs? I said, yeah, no, if you keep well back up, out of the way. So I lit this thing and I went strolled, you know, nonchalantly behind this sort of rock, thinking, oh, I'm well out of the way here. But unfortunately, a piece of rock went up in the air, came down and just caught the tip of this piece that I was sheltering behind, and a little bit shot off and cracked me on the nook. Yeah. So, of course, everybody gathered around me. Oh, yeah. I didn't pass out or anything. It was only a small thing, but it was bleeding. So that started, where's the doctor? Oh, the doctor's out with the governor there. And then there was a lad, George Green. I found out once, after I playfully tapped him, that he was a former Remy boxing champion, a staff sergeant in the Remy. I playfully, you know, punched him, and he not so playfully punched me back, so I never did that again. And he said, I'll stitch his head because we're not going to have a doctor next week. I need the practice, I see, not coming near my head, or words to that effect. And so they sent another lad out to get the governor back. Now, somehow, FIDS always used to muck things up. There was always some chaos or a sort of goon-like sense of humour. Now, Mike Waugh set off with one of the dinghies. The other one was out with the governor. And, of course, he hadn't filled the tank up. It had a little outboard on it, little Seagull outboard. He hadn't filled it up, so halfway across it conked out. And, of course, he hadn't bothered to put oars in. So he stands up and starts waving. And, of course, at the islands, the governor said, what's that fellow waving at? He spoke a bit like that. He was one of the old diplomatic corps. What's he waving at? Mike Waugh it was. And what's his name? The base leader? Len Moe. He said, don't know, sir. So they waved back to him. And eventually they realised there was something going on. Came back. The doctor insisted on stitching my head up and then said, right, it's beer night tonight, but I'll give you an injection and you better not have any beer, which I thought was a bit wrong. Anyway, but that's a story. I got a mention of it in Sir Vivian Fuchs' book, and they'd even heard about it up at What was that, American Beach? Palmerston. On the way out, we stopped there. They laid on a film for us, and Mum came up to me and said, "Are you that one that got his head?" But it was just unfortunate. Because we didn't, in those days, you didn't have things like hard hats or anything like that. You just went behind the rock and hoped.
We had hard heads, didn't we?
So that, I know, what's his name was asking about that.
Alan Weirden.
He was saying, "Is this true?" He'd heard bits and hints about it. But
the weather at Stonington was fairly notorious, wasn't it, for its unreliability?
Could be winds, couldn't it?
Could be winds, yeah.
Coming up, I remember once I was out dog feeding for curiosity. I saw, we always used to watch the plateau at the back, didn't we?
Yeah.
And if it started to spin off, I looked at it once, I thought it was coming off, and it was 20 minutes afterwards.
Right.
It came
0 to 70 knots in 20 minutes.
Catabatics, weren't they?
No, they were.
Catabatic.
They were catabatics. They came in the wake of
it's a good word,
low pressure areas.
So did that affect your working? If you knew that you could be swamped in 70 minutes, in 20
minutes? 20
minutes, yeah. Did that affect your way you planned your work?
Well, the other thing is that there wasn't an awful lot of actual technical work going on at Stonington apart from the scientists writing the things, because mostly it was a field station.
Yeah.
So certainly for us GAs, we were sort of just building up sledges and things like that in the off time. You'd have been doing
scientific.
What were you doing?
Fannying around. I had a bloody dog team to look after and a sledge to build. Come on, and I had my scientific work to do. You could spend your time looking at dirty pictures most of the time.
Well, I did.
What canoe?
You these dirty pictures then, Sykes.
Do you remember that canoe? Ian's story, really. Was it for a plan, or did you just make it?
You built a canoe?
Yeah, I'd been an instructor at Outbound, you know. We'd actually built canoes. They were Clydes. It was a canvas boat, which I'd built a few before I went down. And I actually brought a set of the drawings down with me, I had a pretty good idea how to do it. So I got some of these drawings and modified them and built a one-man canoe. And it was a great project, you know, it was one of these things. I managed to strip wood off some of the Fuchs's old huts, and there was plenty of plywood kicking about on the base and stuff like that. And I used sledge bag canvas to cover it and painted it up to dope it, and it came out quite nice.
Lovely, yeah.
But the amazing thing with the paddle, I made out of a tent pole and some plywood at the end. And the very first day that I went out, I got a life jacket on, and they usually went out for a paddle in it. And I'm paddling along very, you know, and I thought I did a fancy lean over turn with this thing, and the blade snapped off. And I was in, you know, and just...
I got a photograph just before you went in.
Yeah. And the thing was, I managed to get it, because I spent weeks building this bloody thing, and I sort of managed to get out onto a floe, and then I thought, Christ, I'm going to lose it. I had to jump back in again and get the canoe and get it out. And it was great. It was good for sealing. We used it in the summer, you know, for that. And... Ali MacArthur, I think he tried to ban me using it. I think he got a bit nervous because of, you know, accidents and things a bit. But
he was, yeah.
I just refused and kept going. And the other story about that canoe is that I was going to take it home. It went on board the Bisco when we were finally picked up to go home.
Oh.
And we landed up in Argentine Islands, which was beautiful, beautiful place, you know. So I grabbed the canoe and went off out in it. And the base commander there got very shirty about it and said, "Oh, I don't fancy this." But Bunny Fuchs was down. And I'd just taken this thing out. I was having this trouble with the base commander, you see. And Bunny came over and said, "Can I have a go with the canoe?" So off he went paddling up through the bergs and things. And that. And it seemed like a bad thing to take it away, so I actually left it at Argentine Islands. Mm. I think they used it a minute. I've actually found out some history of what happened to it since, I hadn't heard of anything about it, but there are other pictures of it, you know. Mm.
We were talking about the winds and bad weather. I think you've got a story to tell about Phil about a long layup.
Oh, yes. Well, this is when we, with Ken, Ian and I were up in the fjords that first autumn. Mm. And we were on a survey party. And we'd been landed by Biscoe on the Jones Ice Shelf. Well, landed on a beach next to the Jones. And we had a hell of a job getting off that, getting organised. And then we were going up the Heim and over the Antebes down to Lallemand. And the weather was just atrocious. And we got to the foot of Mount Athos. And you had you gone down? Or
we got down the other side, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And we were 18 days?
There's two 11-day lie-ups and one 16-day lie-ups in one winter trip. The thing was that it was our first sledging trip, so we didn't know any different. It all seemed pretty ordinary to us. But Derek Hofflethwaite, who was running the show, was pretty horrified, you know. Yeah. And I heard afterwards that they were very anxious about us in London office, and that, you know, a few years later when they packed in the dogs, that was one of the cited trips that they used. And I was very upset that, because we were having a great time, it was no big deal for us. But back in London, they were hearing about us stranded and having to dig out the... and we made various attempts to get back off the island, which didn't work. But it never ever seemed particularly outrageous to us.
No, from base, I think we were keeping in contact with you. Mm. So I don't think there was ever any sense of worry about it.
No.
But there was one very curious incident there. We were camped at the foot of Mount Athos. Ian had a dog called Athos in his team, and lying up, we listened to the
Grand radio, National, wasn't it?
And there was a horse running in the Grand National called Athos. And we thought,
good on.
This is it. Yeah. So
we got onto the radio to Stanley, and we put a tenner on to win. And it bloody won. It won. And then we discovered they never put the money on. Or they swore blind they hadn't put the money on it, you know.
That is not good. I wasn't radio operator.
I'm sure you were. I think you were.
No,
that's why he's so wealthy. All these swimming around the world he goes on.
I'm going to make a bet from the field.
Well, I mean, radio... Well, the way we were in contact with the outer world was... the squad calls were brilliant, so we could speak through... And I think it went from Adelaide, that particular thing. We'd radio through to Adelaide, and they'd telex. Was it telex they had from Adelaide?
When was this scene? Was it 69, was it?
69.
Yeah. Ah, well, they only got telex into Adelaide.
68
was all, it was still all done on the keys.
Was placing bets a common experience? Yes.
No, absolutely not. It was just a total coincidence.
It was just this
I don't remember
it was a lot, because I can remember us jumping. There was another interesting thing that happened in the same place a bit later.
Yes,
I'll try and tell the story as I saw it. We'd lost the sun by this time. We were stuck with mist. We couldn't get back, so we'd wintered out at Blakelock Fieldhut. And we were working as two separate units, about, 10 miles apart, something like that, on either end of the Jones Ice Shelf, either side, maybe not as far as that. And on this particular day, and I kind of always get mixed up as who was with who, but we sledged by moonlight on a beautiful night across to meet up with everybody, and there was a good reason. And as I always remember it coming in with the dog, the dogs got a sniff of the dogs over at the other side. We had this fantastic run in. And as we got there, normally you would see to your dogs right away, but in this particular instance, we pulled up, picketed the dogs quickly, jumped into the tent, and we listened to Neil Armstrong land on the moon. And it was the most stunning,
absolutely
amazing thing, because it was this great big full moon shining, wasn't it?
Yes, it would have been. It was 27th of July, 1969.
Yeah.
And there was, well, I'd gone across with Brian Gargate, was he my GA? And we met Rod Pashley and Ian Kerfey on Adelaide. We'd come back through Rother across the Leboeuf, is that the north-south field, onto the Jones, and we saw this tent ahead, and that was you. Or was it you and me?
It was you and Pashley. I think you
that's
and me.
Right. Were yes, that's right. I'm sorry. Yes, yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Yeah. And who was it in the tent?
I took him out.
What? Oh, must have been 69.
69, yeah. That was, yes. Yeah. But it was the Jones. It was the same place.
Yeah. Jones talking about, yeah.
How did you hear the moon landing?
On the radio.
On the radio.
Shortwave radio. We were listening to the broadcast.
Listening to the World Service. Yeah.
That was only... Was that a regular... Were you able to do that all the time, or was it dependent upon the atmosphere?
We used to listen to the World Service, and it was
Radio Voice of the Gospel Ecuador, and...
And the Russia...
The Mozambique music one.
And RSA, Radio South Africa.
So just remind me how it felt then to be lying in a tent in the middle of the Antarctic, looking at the moon, thinking, there's a bloke up there.
Extraordinary.
It was extraordinary.
But we felt, I think we felt as remote as they did, almost.
Yeah. In fact, they got a really good map of the moon and where we were. Nobody knew where the bloody hell they were.
But I always remember that. I mean, that's one of the things that sticks in my mind, from the experience.
The odd thing that I've had with it is that because we were there on two or three occasions in the same place, I got a bit mixed up as who I was with.
Yes, yes, well, you've seen that happen just now. Yeah.
That's just happened again. Mm.
So it sounds like you had quite good communication with the rest of the planet.
No, we had, was it every two months? We got a letter from home.
Every month you got 200 words out.
20 words?
No, 200.
I thought it was 100.
It wasn't very many, apart from George Kistrock, with his IQ of 2000, said, well, you strap the words together, make the words very long. And so he had huge communications from his parents.
You're right. Well, I'm thinking of world events. There's quite a lot of turmoil in the world around that time, wasn't there?
Oh, we were listening to the radio all the time. Yes. We were radio freaks. I've never changed, I don't know about everybody else. I can't stop listening to the news now.
We used to string out two aerials. One would be the dipole for the squad call, and the other one would be a long aerial for the hacker
radio receiver.
Radio receiver. Mm.
Yeah. And that was important, was it, to hear what
Yes.
You couldn't just close your back, turn your back on the rest of the world.
No, I think it was...
There was the BBC broadcast, and occasionally they broadcast to us. I can remember.
Calling
Antarctica. And they had this woman, and she was called Maggie Clues.
Oh, that's right.
And she had the most come to bed voice.
Yes.
We were all absolutely in love with her. And I also remember that we wrote a letter to her. I think Chris must have radioed it, to say, we all love you, Maggie Clues, and please can you send us a picture? And you've got a fan club in Antarctica. And the photographs came down the following year.
Yeah.
And she was gorgeous. She was absolutely gorgeous. And then we heard she got married and everybody was very upset.
She used to get messages sent which they broadcast on Port Stanley Radio.
That's right.
I know my parents went into Manchester to record a message to me. And then every month?
BBC did it on the overseas. Well,
so you heard from your parents?
Yes.
They broadcast?
Yes.
Oh, did you?
That was happening, yeah. Oh. I mean, you'd see blokes sort of cringing in case something stupid or embarrassing was said by your parents. Yeah, my parents went over to Manchester and they broadcast this thing and, they made them welcome. And that used to happen. And they used to... Was it calling the Antarctic?
Calling the Antarctic.
Mummy and Daddy didn't do that for me.
No, they didn't. I used to have to read the air letters out.
Air letters, that's what they were called.
Air letters. You used to get 200 words, I think, out 100 words.
Yeah.
And I had to read them out to the field sledge.
I never got that, so you must have abridged them.
I had to do in certain cases.
What was the midwinter like then?
Can't remember.
So the answer is yes, it was.
Yeah. Everybody got dressed.
When we were on the, we got stranded on the Heimglass. We were in Blakelock Field. We wrote a play, which we put on at Stonington for a belated midwinter.
Yeah,
I can remember very upset because the entire cast were drunk when they were
playing. What was the play about?
It was called Seal Morning, wasn't it?
Seal Morning?
Yes, it had...
Doyle and Chris Elliott being...
Yeah, Chris...
Me?
...prosecuted for sealing, and there was all the manner
gosh,
of...
Gosh, you've got...
Do you remember weird characters? Yeah. We had two Midwinters 1 year. Do you remember? I think that was 1968.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that was the one, wasn't it? Because so many people were out.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
MacArthur decided without two Midwinters. I've got photographs of that.
Yes, that's right.
We couldn't get
Midwinter one and Midwinter two. Yeah.
Mm. Because we were awesome. Back later.
Ken,
were
you? Did you say any special for Midwinter 68?
Show you any what?
Did you do anything special to help everybody celebrate Midwinter in 60?
Not if I could help it, no. don't think so.
I think one of the things we ought to talk about is...
Did you not take presents for them?
Presents?
Yes,
indeed. Oh, well, that's right, yes. There was... So anybody going back down... The survey backed us up with it. In fact, you had one of those things, didn't you?
No, well, that's...
It sent out to any parents saying that... telling them about this Midwinter doing, would they like to send small presents? And this was signed by me in this particular case, to say that I would make sure that these presents were kept hidden away in my equipment, and then when Midwinter came, I would hand them out, which was a sort of nice surprise for everybody else on the base. I think I got one.
I think everybody did it every year.
Yeah, everybody did it every year, yes. Yeah. Just something small, little token which you can pull out, and on Midwinter Day, which was the sort of annual holiday, if that's the word, they got something different.
Mm. Yeah, Smith, you were trying to say something.
Well, I was just going to mention the music, which I think was very important to many of us. I mean, there was someone we haven't talked about who's called Pedro. Do you remember Pedro?
Francesco. No. Francesco.
Was it
Francesco?
And Francesco liked to drink, didn't he?
Yeah. Ah.
This was Ken's guitar.
Oh.
And he used to pour beer into this guitar.
Awesome. I didn't pour it in.
Yes, I've got a picture of you doing it.
I wouldn't waste beer on.
He was just acting for you.
But, I mean, one of the...
Yeah, it was quite... it was we used to amuse me.
Yes, it was great. But
oh, that piano.
Yeah, the piano. Yes.
Was there a piano?
Behind the bar.
Yeah. No, that should have gone to Halle Bay.
Well, the piano.
Yeah.
Oh, should it?
It should have gone in 1965 to Halle Bay.
Oh.
There was a doctor, a Scouser, who managed to get hold of this player piano. The old style way, you press pedals, and it was supposed to puff air and Figueroa, right?
Pianola.
Yeah. Ah. Now, he, after that accident where Muskeg went down at Halle Bay, they were short of a doctor, so this lad was, instead of coming to Stonington, he was shunted to Halle Bay.
Poor chap.
Put the piano still came to Stonington. Now, this thing, I remember, it was a terrible state it was. The actual, with no things for it, to these tube
rolls.
And I thought, well, there must be some way of doing this. And had you arrived then?
Oh, I'm sure I had. Well,
I borrowed a spanner and then tuned this piano. Turning around the keys until it got approximately in tune. So it was quite...
That's extraordinary. I'd forgotten about that. I have got a pianola at home.
They're worth a lot of money.
I'd no idea. I'd completely forgotten why I'd bought
it. You pinched it from Stonington.
Yeah, just quite
that's true.
And that would explain.
5 minutes left. I was wondering if there's anything that you wanted to say, which I haven't asked you. I mean,
Cape Jeremy.
Yes,
oh,
I think.
No.
Go on, Ian. This is Ian Sykes.
Well, I'm thinking of the Puffball Islands incident. Was the one that one of the aircraft had crashed to the previous summer.
The Porter.
Yeah. And the boys got landed at Fossil Bluff for the winter. Supposed to be going home, and there they were stranded. And So Flay and his group set off rather earlier than we would normally go to try and get down to the bluff and relieve it.
Alan Carter, Lawrence Willie,
Sean Norman.
Me and Sean.
Yeah. So the four of them set off, and it was glorious weather. We got the sun had returned, and we had a lovely spring, and off they went. And of course, as soon as they got over the safety column round past Terra Firma Island, the weather sort of clamped in a bit, and this big blow came out of
Windy Valley.
The next thing, from my point of view, Flay will tell his side of it, but from my point of view, we had this radio message that they were on sea ice. Mm. They'd crossed a number of leads, and it had opened up behind them, and they had the feeling they were on the move.
They
were on the move, and big panic. Very few people had gone drifting off on sea ice and returned. So Ken and myself and Thwaites, was it?
Thwaites. Yeah.
The three of us, we loaded the sledge with a dinghy. And set intrepidly forth to go. And I think the good thing for me was that because of the previous accidents, the early years, Alan MacArthur had been very cautious, and we were only sledging in extremely fine weather. You know, one of the reasons probably why these 11-day and 16-day alliance were at Heim, where we could have probably travelled, but policy was go careful.
It was.
So on this occasion, we were going like, I think that was the first time I realised we could actually travel in much worse weather. Mm. And we really started plonking it on. Anyway, as it all turned out, from our side of it, we got down, we camped at the Debenham Islands, was it?
Terra Firma.
No, there was an Argy base. There was a little Argentine base.
No, that's Debenhams, which is to the north.
Anyway, we went on past, and then we crossed a couple of leads, but got sledge to cross, and there was water sky all over the place. You know, this where you get the leads reflected on the clouds, so we knew there was open water about. But as it turned out, the further south we got, the better the weather got. Yeah. Mm. We finally got to the Puffball Islands just at the same time that you arrived there.
We turned back, yeah.
And, all was well by that time. The leads and things were closing up. So it wasn't the big epic that we turned out. But we gave up the idea of trying to get to the bluff and headed back.
I think the interesting thing was we had obviously been talking on the radio to Chris, and you had got onto London, and they had looked at satellite photographs, and they could see the icebergs and leads opening up, and suddenly the skies, the man on the moon next year, and suddenly technology was helping, it was a quite very salutary experience. We were on half rations. I can remember seeing a pod of seals and my mouth was watering.
Best years of your life?
I think absolutely.
No question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember that scene as we went away on the Biscoe, the little knot of men on the ice, Stonington in the background, the northeast coming down.
Mm. Oh.
Fantastic.
Yeah.